Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. Through our events, publications, and podcasts, we provide the space and opportunities needed by academic leaders among Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox communities for professional growth and intellectual discipleship. Since 2012, we have been building a network of friends with a love for our core themes, tradition, place, and things divine, and with a genuine commitment to the church and the life of the mind. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal, Pietas, and to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Before we get started, please join me in prayer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless our conversation and that all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. I'm grateful to be joined today by a longtime friend and one of my former professors, Paul DeHart. Dr. Paul R. DeHart is professor of political science at Texas State University, where he has taught since August 2009. Prior to that, he was assistant professor of political science at Lee University from 2005 to 2009, which is also when I was there as an undergraduate. He holds a PhD from the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin and a BA in political science and philosophy from Houghton College. While at Houghton, he also did something I did. He studied classical vocal performance, but he studied with the late, I think it's Paul Giles, a founding performer of the Boston Lyric Theater. Dr. DeHart specializes in the American founding, early modern political theory, especially Hobbes and Locke, social contract theory, the grounds of political authority and obligation, the relationship between religion and political order, natural law, and constitutional design. He is author of the book Uncovering the Constitution's Moral Design, also by University of Missouri Press in 2007, and a paperback came out 10 years later, as well as the book we're discussing today, The Social Contract in the Ruins, Natural Law and Government by Consent, University of Missouri Press, that was last year as well. DeHart also was editor with Carson Holloway of Reason, Revelation, and the Civic Order, Political Philosophy, and the Claims of Faith. That was NIU Press 2014, and he has also published articles in journals such as Polity, Critical Review, Locke Studies, Perspectives on Political Science, Catholic Social Science Review, and there's a lot more I could say. He's done a lot, certainly an impressive scholar with me today and a good friend. Thanks. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me. I think you forgot to mention that I also had some of my public scholarship discussed in some years ago to failing presidential primary campaign.
So, I didn't want to bring that up. I mean, so if you really want to lose the election, make sure you're using Paul's stuff.
I think so. Yeah.
Well, this book, Social Contract in the Ruins, is a philosophically and technically challenging book, and we're going to try and summarize the argument to our very broad audience, and that's the task before us. But I think it will be rewarding. I think it helps us think more clearly about really political theory generally, but also specifically about the constitutional order that we live in. I want to go relatively quickly through parts one and two, and then we'll get a little more detailed on part three and your notion of covenantal realism. Yep. So let's start here. Give us a simple explanation, especially for those of us who have never taken a political theory class, what social contract theory is and why it's so important to understand.
Yeah. And I will brush over a distinction that's big for some scholars. I'm going to sort of treat social contract theory and government by consent as the same things, and sometimes those are used as the same thing.
Right.
But I take social contract theory to be predicated on a rejection of the idea that political authority of some over others and political obligations of others to obey the law. Historically, those have often been grounded on some sort of divine authorization. Maybe in certain versions, the king is divine. In certain other versions, very common, the king is the high priest. Also, natural subordination or natural hierarchy. Some are fit by nature to rule and others fit to be ruled. And social contract theory begins with the idea that human beings are equal by nature, and that on account of this equality, no one is by nature a ruler over others, as you might say that human beings are over other animals like dogs or horses or what have you. And given that some people are not by nature rulers over others, then on social contract theory, consent is necessary to authorize political authority, whether we're talking about individuals or the regime, more accurately, the governance, and to incur political obligations. Now, in the early modern version of this that we find in Thomas Hobbes or John Locke or Jean-Jacques Rousseau, although as we'll note, there are actually earlier roots, and in a somewhat recent piece, I argue that there are two competing social contract traditions, one that has roots in folks like Richard Hooker, the Anglican divine, and who sometimes said to have provided the Elizabethan settlement in England with respect to church and state. But he talks about for instance government by consent. And then there's the distinctly modernist strain that we talk about with Thomas Hobbes, who was a British political theorist who started publishing in the mid 17th century, and his main work, Leviathan, appeared in 1651. And other folks subsequent to him, and they begin with a state of nature. There is, for Hobbes, no society. It's not as true for other social contract theorists in the state of nature, but Hobbes says no society at all of any kind. And then no commonwealth or no political society. And then no sovereign or no authority, political authority, and no law, no civil law, no human law. Hobbes just says no law. And of course, they present life in the state of nature. Hobbes, in particular, identifies the state of nature as a state of war. He says, human beings are equal in things like strength, so nobody can secure their own preservation by themselves. They can't secure themselves by themselves. And human beings in a what he calls the natural condition would be motivated to invade each other. And so he says the state of nature is a state of war. And in the state of war, life is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. And human beings live in constant fear, perpetual fear of sudden and violent death, which he says is worst of all. It's a war of everyone against everyone. Now, somebody like John Locke, who writes some decades later, and who exercised some degree of influence with the American founders and framers, although that has been a bone of contention, both how to understand Locke, how is Locke rightly understood, and what is his relation to the American founders and framers. Locke's a British theorist whose two treatises are published after the Glorious Revolution in 1688. His treatises, two treatises of government, published in 1689. But we know that he was writing his second treatise, in which he justifies a right of revolution in the 1680s, actually, and much earlier than the Glorious Revolution, and arguably to justify a revolution coming in England. Well, Locke doesn't identify the state of nature as a state of war. They're not the same thing, but the state of nature in which there is no political society, that for Locke there may be familial society or other things like that, but there is no political society in the state of nature. He says it nevertheless inevitably and probably very quickly becomes a state of war in which your life, your liberty, your property are all very insecure. And individuals end up at war with each other. The state of nature becomes a state of war. And for both them, for Hobbes and for Locke, then the way out, or the way to avoid, the way to escape this state of nature in which your preservation or your life, liberty, and estate, for Locke, are radically insecure, is an agreement, and to speak in Hobbesian terms for a moment, that authorizes, or let me back that up, that establishes a commonwealth, that creates a commonwealth, and authorizes a sovereign power. Now, for Hobbes, this is wed to his political absolutism. We authorize in the covenant of everyone with everyone an absolute and unlimited sovereign power. And that's because for Hobbes, individuals in the state of nature have the right to everything and to do anything in order to survive. And nothing is right or wrong, just or unjust. Individuals have complete and total liberty. And when they leave the state of nature, they authorize a sovereign with such power. Locke looks at that and says, that's horrifying. We want political authority that does not have absolute and arbitrary power. And after all, individuals don't have absolute and arbitrary power over their own lives. And they can't give more authority or power than they have. And so they can only give to government when they authorize it by consent, or political society first, which then delegates the government limited authority over them and over others. But the point of what Hobbes calls the covenant, agreement of everyone with everyone, or what Locke calls a social compact, is to create a political order that saves us from the predation ruins of war that we find in the state of nature. And so we begin with natural equality and say, if some people are going to have political authority over others, it must be on the basis of consent, given that they're equal. Also, if they were to choose to live in a state of nature without civil government, that would be a truly awful, unbearable condition that either is identical with the state of war, that becomes a state of war. And so individuals seek to leave it by what comes to be called, although not until Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the social contract. It's really with Rousseau's Le Contrat Social that that term takes hold. Now, for a lot of people, this whole tradition just begins with Hobbes, and I want to contest that. But one of the reasons that that's important for us, as insofar as we are talking about consent and the necessity of consent for some people to have political authority over others and others to have an obligation to obey, that way of thinking very much influenced the American founding and framing. And we can see not only what might be called popular sovereignty elements in the documents and the pamphlets of the American founding period, the revolutionary period, but we can also see what we might call social contract elements, some discussion of a state of nature and what life would be like in the state of nature, and the necessity of civil society and government in order to avoid or to forestall a state of nature. And we see this in the Virginia Declaration of Rights. I think we see this in the Declaration of Independence. We see this in various state constitutions. And so ideas that we associate with social contract theory, natural equality, that some people are not that nobody, excuse me, that no one is a subject by nature, that we are not under political authority by nature, and you could call that natural liberty, and the idea that consent then is really necessary for political authority and obligations. We see these ideas commonly associated with social contract theory that are part and parcel of the American founding and framing. Although part of my argument, or part of what I'm getting at, both in the book and in some articles, is that all of those ideas, of course, predate Thomas Hobbes, and in several cases have much older roots.
Well, let's get to that. That's actually a really important point there, because one of the things that is often We conceive of the American founding, at least in some circles. You and I don't do this, but some circles you'll conceive of the American founding as very much an Enlightenment project, right? It's drawing from these modern sources exclusively in some ways. It's improving on these different things. So scholars have historically placed this social contract theory that you're describing, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, et cetera, and then classical natural law, such as Aristotle, Cicero, Augustine, Aquinas, at odds with each other. Explain why scholars tend to do that. And the whole book is meant to explain why they're wrong about this. But let's just at least begin by saying, why do some scholars say, look, they're actually at odds, social contract theory is departure from this older tradition?
Yeah, I think that's because some scholars see Thomas Hobbes as the headwaters of social contract theory. And they might concede that there are elements of social contract or consent theory that are earlier. Maybe you could find it in Greece. And in fact, maybe you could find it in Plato. Oh, but where you find it in Plato, it's in Glaucon and his argument against justice, right? But so they say, oh, to the extent that it's an antiquity, it's not classical political thought, but it's what they oppose. Or they might say, well, Aristotle says that having an agreement with respect to trade or the ability to for individuals with across this agreement to intermarry or an agreement not to harm and be harmed by each other, and Aristotle says that's not sufficient for a political order in the proper sense. And so they'll say, well, that classical antiquity was opposed to covenant, social contract, government by consent. But Hobbes is really the fountainhead here, and then sometimes there's an effort to argue that either Locke somehow reduces to Hobbes, or that he's a kind of Hobbesian. The more sophisticated accounts might suggest that Locke is correcting Hobbes or something like that. But there is a tendency to see Thomas Hobbes at the root and as the foundation of social contract theory. And then when you read Thomas Hobbes, what you find are, of course, materialism, everything that exists is matter in motion, determinism. But scholars might say, well, is that necessarily connected to his political theory project? And there are a number of scholars who say, no, we don't think that it is. And I'm sort of like, well, he thought that Leviathan was a kind of axiomatic deductive theory. I think that Hobbes thought that it was. But even if it's not, the next thing is that Hobbes is a nominalist, right? That there are no real universals. There are only particulars. He says what we call universals are just general names, but universals like man or human or trinus or what have you, those don't really exist. They're just particulars. The general name is we might say a scientific convenience for organizing our thought. And then he says, good and evil are subjective by nature. That is, they are relative to desire and aversion. And he says, nothing is simply or absolutely good or evil, and no rules about good and evil to be drawn from the nature of things or acts themselves. But rather, good is for someone that which they desire, and it's good for them because they desire it. And evil is that to which they are averse because they're averse to it. So if I am hungry and I'm wandering in the forest and I happen across an orchard, good fortune, and I see the apple, and it's in good shape, it's a good apple, it smells good, I am drawn to it as I taste it, I'm drawn to have more of it. Oh, the apples are good for me. But I see the rattlesnake and it's rattling, and I'm averse to that. Well, I don't want to embrace the snake. I'm not running at it saying, "Brother, I'm moving away." Well, that's I'm averse to it. Then it's an evil for me. And Hobbes will say in Leviathan that good and evil vary not only by nature, across societies, but within a society, across individuals, and within an individual over time. Because at one time you praise and call good something that at another time you dispraise and call evil. And I suppose anyone who's ever had children And you get the black, I hate this. Why are you feeding this to me when they're very young? And you're like, you just loved it and asked for it last week, you know. Right. So and so but of course what Hobbes is doing is reducing good and evil to taste. And then he says, but that's by nature. In a commonwealth, good and evil is relative to the will of the commonwealth, the law, the sovereign. At other places, he'll say things like, true sciences, he says, are completely a priori, which means they're not experience based at all. They're not a posteriori, and completely demonstrative and deductive. As such, he thinks, is geometry. And then he says, because it results from principles that we make. And Euclid is doubtless rolling over in his grave as Hobbes writes this. And then Hobbes says, physics is not, physics is a mixed mathematics. It's partly observational and it's partly deductive. It's not a pure science. And then he says, but politics and ethics, which are the sciences of just and unjust, are pure a priori demonstrative sciences because the principles of justice result from our making them. That's not all there is to say. In chapter 31 of Leviathan, he seems to say that the ground of obligation of anyone to do or of the laws of nature is the irresistible might and omnipotent will of God. The point is that for Hobbes, good and evil are made. They're constructed. And for him, the laws of nature, from the standpoint of nature and reason alone, he says they're not really laws. I say, what are they? Well, the laws of nature are really means for escaping or avoiding falling into the state of nature. The laws of nature tell us how to avoid the state of nature, and they may be always true that certain kinds of actions tend towards war, right? Partiality, for instance, breaking covenants made and things like that always leads us to war with others. And other actions always tend towards peace, right? But good and evil are subjective. Well, in classical natural law, of course, it's not only the case that some things are right for everyone, everywhere, always, the most fundamental requirements of the moral law, but there is this essential connection of the moral law, which is prescriptive, to an objective intrinsic good. Good is that which is to or sorry, the natural law prescribes for us that we are to do good and to preserve good, to do and ensue good, and to avoid evil. And at the most fundamental level, we're dealing with actions that are intrinsically good, intrinsically just, and intrinsically evil, intrinsically unjust. And Hobbes' constructivist view, the idea that morals are constructed by us, by God, by both, rejects this notion of a real, eternal, uncreated good
And
and
so,
of good and evil.
just to sum up then here, so what we've got then at this point, and this kind of you can see this in our own day, right? Is it that it's, it's my truth, it's your truth, that's kind of the extreme version. Hobbes might, you could argue Hobbes doesn't even take it that far, but
No, that's
he's
right.
pointing in that direction, right? I mean, it makes sense that in a world that is so saturated with kind of a Hobbes lock, and especially Rousseau for that matter, this kind of later subjectivism comes out of that, in the sense that social contract theory seems to be, or kind of an extreme version of it, unrooted from classical natural law and the classical notions, classical and Christian notions, ends up in kind of the Planned Parenthood v. Casey, Kennedy's statement, right? That, the freedom is basically to define your own reality. I don't know, that's not a quote, but essentially that's what he's saying. And so you call this will and artifice, like that those that the idea that you can construct, or well, the idea that obligation, the idea that the legitimacy of a regime is rooted simply in the will, whether it's of the people or the sovereign or even of God, that if you simply base everything on will and this construction, It is not going to, it's not going to work. And you specifically say that it's self-referentially coherent and it's a normative failure. Those two things. It's self-referentially incoherent, a normative
Yes.
failure. Well, that's pretty damning. I guess run us, what's the quick, well, quick-ish version of why social contract theory uprooted from classical natural law ends up becoming self-referentially incoherent and a normative failure.
Yeah, so let me and let me broaden that a little bit, but getting at what you were saying there is I want to say that any account of ought or obligation that is completely will-based and in which ought and obligation are constructed or a function of will, be it our will, be it the conventions of the community, be it the will of the mortal god Leviathan, the sovereign power, or be it a sheer divine omnipotence, that this eliminates ought altogether. Oughtness is gone with this. The self-referential incoherence argument goes something like this, and we'll say the main premise for that argument is that well, let me back up. In any account of political authority and obligation, right, we are deeming some instances of will, even insofar as we talk about valid law for a community, to be normative for others, right? You obey or you disobey, and there's this law, and the law is a human law. It's been enacted. The question is, could that be grounded on will alone? And my answer is no. And here's the main premise: because it is impossible, intelligibly or coherently, to distinguish some instances of will from others on the basis of nothing but will, right? And that actually instantiates a broader principle. Think for me, think with me for a moment about math. And I won't stretch everybody too hard on math, but presumably,
I was going to say, like, based on a Hobbesian set of value, I mean, I think math is evil. I don't desire it, right?
Don't tell my father-in-law. He's a mathematician, but he always wondered if political science should be called political science. And I always told him it's usually historically been taught called politics and government, and they used to call physics physical science. So, but that's for those who say if science is in the name, it's not really a science. I'm like, they used to call it departments of physical science,
That's
biological
right.
science. So, anyway, yeah. So. The set of prime numbers starts with two, runs to infinity. There's a proof for that, and we don't need to go into that. Just take my word for it. It starts with two and runs to infinity. Now, suppose somebody came up to me and said, "I would like to distinguish 13." From 2, 5, 7, and all the other prime numbers on the basis of primeness. And you'd say, well, that's crazy. 13's a prime. You could distinguish 13 from 4, 6, and 8 on the basis of primeness, but you can't distinguish it from other primes on the basis of primeness, from 2, 3, 5, 7, 17. That's an incoherent idea. And so if we took the set of all prime numbers, you would say, listen, you can't distinguish some prime numbers from others on the basis of primeness, or some odd numbers from other odd numbers on the basis of oddness. And the reason you can't do that is that you can't distinguish among the members of any set on the basis of the predication of the property by which the set is defined. Well, you say, well, why does that matter? You say, well, listen, there are we can conceive of a set of every exercise of will, potential and actual, and to take, for instance, the will to read, and maybe instantiated in the reading of C.S. Lewis's Till We Have Faces, his greatest novel, right up there with Perelandra. The will to drink a Chianti or a Dr. Pepper, the instance of will where you go rock climbing and rappelling at Rattlesnake Point in Canada. I did that once without thinking that Rattlesnake Point might actually mean there were rattlesnakes. I mean, I put my hands and my feet in all kinds of holes without even thinking about it. And the acts of individual will to come on a podcast with Josh Bowman. And then there are acts of corporate will to build a park, to build a road, to fund a school, the majority will, the minority. Well, insofar as these are all instances of will, right? You can't distinguish some instances of will from the other from others on the basis of will alone. So what follows from that necessarily is I can't say, here is an instance of will that is normative or obligatory for other instances of will on the basis of will alone. To do so, to say, here is an instance of will that is obligatory or in some way normative for other instances of will, is to presuppose then a rule and measure, a basis of ought or a good, if you will, that transcends the set of instances of will. So those who want to come along and say, well, no, ought and obligation or political obligation is just based on nothing but will, and it's binding for others. And you say, well, no, you can't intelligibly do that. So you're presupposing some non-will basis of ought that transcends, right? And what is a human construction all by itself? But it's just will. If we're merely constructing, if we're sheerly constructing things, and so insofar as we take instances of will to really bind, or to really provide an ought or an obligation, like an obligation to obey a law and a constitutional order, then the basis of that must necessarily be presupposed some real good, some real right, not itself reducible to will. And in that presupposing, for the sake of coherence, what is being presupposed is what is denied by all those who say, no, good ought. Obligation, any kind of obligatory good, is just that which is made by us as godlets, to borrow a term from all excuse me, Arthur Allen Leff, or by the community, or by the state, or even by God. C.S. Lewis used to say, and you find this in The Poison of Subjectivism, though not only there, there's no way to distinguish between God and the devil and what should be praised and worshipped if you reduce God to sheer will. But I want to suggest, as Hobbes tries in chapter 31 of Leviathan, to say, the ultimate foundation of the laws of nature is irresistible might, omnipotent power, right? This is why God has a right to punish Job. It's not because Job sinned or did anything unjust. I mean, God can punish him for that if he wants to. And he's using the word punish. I'm not suggesting that punishing is what's going on in Job. But Hobbes uses that word, and he says, no, if God wants to punish Job, then the only ultimate foundation for it is God's really powerful. He's omnipotent, and he's irresistible might. And even in the case of God, that, as Lewis says, that doesn't allow us to distinguish between God and an omnipotent devil. You've read the Space Trilogy, right? Or I should say, I should correct this, the Ransom Trilogy.
That's right.
Ransom is speaking with this character from the early volume. He's become, like, in what's supposed to be paradise, the equivalent of the devil or the tempter, the unman. And the unman says to Ransom at some point, well, don't you worship God? Because he's energy. And it's Peter Craig pointed out to me in an email one time. What the unman means there is because he's powerful. Don't you worship God because he's powerful? And Ransom says, no, we worship him because he's good. Well, I want to suggest that It's either an eternal, and I have the argument for it in the book, an eternal, uncreated good at the foundation of everything, or nothing when it comes to ought and obligation. But as C.S. Lewis would say, if the good exists, it's eternal and uncreated. A real good can't be a created thing. It's fundamental. So the moment we begin to speak of a created good and a created evil, whether it's by us or sheer omnipotence, we have already departed from a coherent point of view. And this is, I think, part and parcel of the natural law tradition, is that you want ought, you need a real transcendent good, and it's not made at all. It's eternal. Now, prescription is also part of this and necessary, but I think that's where the conflict comes from, is that a lot of people conflate two senses of what we might call social contract. And one of those senses, and it's not the only thing going on in Hobbes, but I would argue that there's a strain of it in Hobbes, is that morality, ought, is constructed. And maybe in the English-speaking world, a guy named David Gautier, 20th century, but he's published some stuff in the 21st century. He's been around a long time. Is maybe the leading theorist of moral contractarianism. That is, that moral obligation is constructed and built. So I think there's some roots in Hobbes, and some roots in sophists, sophism, of course. Some roots in Hobbes for that, but we really find that full blown. And maybe we find a version of that with John Rawls, and we don't have to get all the way into this, but what was called Kantian constructivism, that ought is something constructed or built. But I've always thought that Jean Hampton was right to suggest that political contractarianism and moral contractarianism are distinct things. And I'm arguing that they are mutually exclusive and incompatible things. So moral contractarianism says we build right and wrong. We construct it, or it's constructed somehow or other by us, by individually in community, made by the law, etc. Political contractarianism says that consent is a necessary condition for political authority and obligation, but moral contractarianism doesn't imply political contractarianism or the necessity of consent. And the idea that the consent of the governed is necessary for political authority and obligation does not presuppose moral contractarianism. In fact, they are very much at odds with each other. And that's something that the American founders and framers understood.
Well, yeah, and so let's go to that then, because one of the things that someone could take away from this, if they're not familiar, especially if they're not familiar with the classical law tradition, or they have a very Enlightenment version of the American founding, if you will, look, if this is all self-reg, if social contract theory, a moral contractarianism, social contract, political, whatever, that if this is all self-referentially incoherent, if it's a normative failure, does that mean the American founding is a normative failure? Does that mean that our is you know is the authority of our own constitution, our own political tradition, is has have we been following for the last 249 years a self-referentially incoherent regime of political obligation, and are you unintentional? I mean, I realize this gets to your first book, and I'm kind of you don't try and summarize the whole thing, but I mean, what one of the things here is that you could take away from this, potentially, if you're not careful, that, well, crap, this is all, it's a house of straw, right? That we've actually that you've unintentionally undermined the constitutional order that I assume you prefer. And so, I mean, are you giving weight to, and again, I know this is not true, but I'm going to ask the provocative question, right? Are you giving weight to the kind of the post-liberal argument that says, look, liberalism is dead. It's self-referentially incoherent, detaches us from anything good. There is no capital G good at all. We have to abandon it entirely. So, is, is that what where you're headed with this? So that if we can't rely on this, what can we rely on? You know, is that where this is going?
And my answer is emphatically not. I think that the post-liberals have, especially those who associate the American founding and framing with Hobbes, for instance, have misread it completely. When Alexander Hamilton says in that exchange in front of the Revolution with the pseudonymous exchange, but with the loyalist Anglican minister Samuel Seabury, that Hobbes subverts the foundations of this, and he accuses the loyalist Samuel Seabury of being a Hobbesian about the state of nature, and says Hobbes is wrong, and he invokes Blackstone, but he invokes Blackstone where Blackstone is basically quoting Cicero. I think that Hamilton is being quite sincere, and certainly James Wilson was. So my project is, if anything, although I don't, but let's put it this way, it is anti-post-liberal, although I'm trying to do something constructive, and don't spend a great deal of time. Let me recommend to your listeners an article I wrote on why the American regime is not Hobbesian. That's in my first book on covering the Constitution's moral design, especially in chapters 3, 4, and 5 of that volume, but also an article I wrote that I inelegantly titled "Why." Yes, let's get this right. Why liberalism fails as an account of the American regime. It's not the best title in the world, and I was being a bit of a smart ass, and I repent for my sin. And that's a reference to a post-liberal book that says the American regime, if you will, was founded in the sin of Hobbes, and that the American Constitution is the technology of modernist and especially Hobbesian political theory, and I think that that is fundamentally wrong. And then another article I wrote, and folks will excuse me for riffing the late Alistair MacIntyre, whose social contract? Whose social contract? In which I argue that there is an older social contract tradition that predates Thomas Hobbes, and so. Let me talk a little bit about that. First, folks will say Hobbes begins with the state of nature, and life in this natural condition is truly awful. And given that people are equal, given that it's awful, they want to leave it. Given that they're equal, they can only leave it by consent. And isn't this the sort of modern frame? And I want to say, no, but that's older than Hobbes. We can find the not only the phrase state of nature, or if you will, statu naturale, and equivalents, before Hobbes, we find them in Salamancan school theorists in Spain. Salamanca, Spain, is a university and a school of thought, and it included some Dominicans, and one in particular early on, and then some Jesuits like Francisco Suarez in the late 16th and early 17th century. And these guys are Molina, Vasquez, Suarez, Soto, and others. They're not rote followers of Thomas Aquinas, but they are, if you will, Renaissance or revival Thomist thinkers, Thomist revival thinkers, we might call them, right? And they speak of a state of nature, a natural condition in which there is no commonwealth and no political authority. They describe it on account of original sin as a state in which individuals are selfish, in which they are, to borrow a phrase from Locke, partial towards themselves. You find that in Suarez and Soto and Molina. They're partial towards themselves. They are inclined to infringe unjustly on others, to wrong others, and then the Salamancan school before Hobbes, decades before Hobbes, these theorists say, and there's no remedy, there's no redress in the state of nature for the injuries people inflict on each other. But it's an awful condition, and they want out. Oh, and also they say, decades before Hobbes, people are equal by nature. And so it's going to require their consent to avoid the state of nature or to escape the state of nature. And they believe there might have even been a period of time in which you really had a state of nature, and political society needed to be established, created, authorized. But you had familial society in the state of nature, and for them, you had a real moral law. Right? And so they begin with human equality, but they say, given human sinfulness, if there was no sovereign power, life would be truly awful. How do we get out of that? Well, given human equality, we need to do it by means of consent. But they also posit a natural law. So there is this the framework that Hobbes uses is older. And I could go back even further. Really, I think the beginning of what we might call political contractarianism or political social contract theory, the idea that consent is necessary for political authority and obligations, we could go back with respect to that idea of equality all the way back, natural equality, to early Christian writers. So we find Lactantius saying that that human beings are created by nature equal, that they have a natural moral equality. We find Ambrose of Milan, one of Augustine's teachers, affirming natural moral equality, and on that ground, denouncing violations of the poor by the rich. He says you don't consider yourselves equal. But you are naturally morally equal. And then we see Gregory the Great. He says, if you're a ruler and you think you're made of better stuff, he says that's pride, and that's the sin of the devil, whom he calls Leviathan, interestingly enough. So these three thinkers, and not only them, but posit natural moral equality. I could note that Aristotle did not. He seems very clearly to think that human beings are some are fit to rule and others fit to be ruled by nature based on share of reason when it comes towards directing towards the good, the fulfillment of an individual or of family or of the polis, on the one hand. But he says something interesting too. He says, but insofar as people are equal, who rules who is not given by nature. Right? And so we get from Aristotle the idea that if people are equal, nature doesn't establish who rules. We need something else. Now he says that people should then rule and be ruled in turn. But there are some like Gene Hampton who says, you could move that in the direction of a genuine consent theory. But what's interesting to me is that doubtless with St. Paul in the background, in Christ there is neither slave nor free, Jew nor Greek, doubtless with the Apostle Paul in the background, there's this idea of this fundamental equality. But Paul's saying in the most important fundamental fellowship or society that you could have, human beings are to be treated as equal to each other, neither slave nor free. And so we get this. And then Gregory of Nyssa just shatters the scale. I'm sure you know of the work of Kyle Harper, who's a great late Roman historian. He's the provost at Oklahoma now. In a volume called Christianity and Freedom,
It's a
he
great
has this
book.
chapter in which he says, there are people who said there's some foundation for equality in Stoicism. And he says it really reading an already Christianized Stoicism. And I think that's right, because I think some of these people must include Lactantius, who was a Christian, right? And Lactantius invokes Cicero. But they'll say, the Stoics thought people were equal insofar as they said everybody has dignity, dignitas. Harper says, for the Stoics, actually, dignitas comes on a sliding scale. Some have more and some have less. But Gregory of Nyssa, drawing on this passage in the Gospels, Jesus of Nazareth says, "What does it profit a man to gain the cosmos and to lose his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul?" And Gregory says Jesus is just saying there, maybe we would say presupposing, but Gregory seems to say that Jesus is saying there that each soul is worth more than the whole cosmos. And says Harper, what Gregory's and Gregory's argue, he uses this as a basis to say that slavery is wrong. Now, Plato says a slave is an embarrassing possession. Gregory says slavery is wrong to the enslaved. There's no such thing as a real moral natural foundation for it. And Harper says Gregory here has shattered the Stoic sliding scale. And that was really the best you could do in Greco-Roman antiquity in terms of human equality, was everyone has dignitas, but it comes on a sliding scale. And Gregory of Nyssa shatters that. So we have with Gregory of Nyssa, sorry, with also Ambrose of Milan, Gregory the Great, Lactantius, who was a Christian writer who was tutor to Constantine the Great's son, a member of Constantine the Great's court, this idea of natural moral equality. And Aquinas himself talks about this a little bit later on. Well, if we move to the late 16th and the early 17th century, and we begin to encounter the Salamancan Thomists, and we also run across not only Francisco Suarez, but Cardinal Bellarmine, who's a Catholic Thomist, who is a critic of King James I in England. Bellarmine's not in England, but he's a critic of James I, who had begun articulating ideas of divine right. But like in terms of the absolute power of the sovereign, and the king is the sovereign, and also patriarchal ideas about natural hierarchies and things like this. And Bellarmine criticizes James I, and in his writings, Bellarmine says, you know what? People are equal by nature, and equal by nature means that they delegate a government, but they never alienate power to a government. The community never gives up its political authority. They never just transfer it wholesale to a government. They always retain it, and they retain, therefore, the right and authority to depose and replace tyrannical governments on grounds of human equality.
Now let's stop there, because one of the things that as you're talking about this is it's reminding me of a source where I first encountered this argument was actually in Quentin Skinner's Foundations of Modern Political Thought, especially Volume 2, which I think is unjustly neglected. It's great. And what's interesting to me with that is, and this is with Skinner, he's uncovering all kinds of these what are often thought to be modern ideas of natural rights and dignity and equality and all these things that are often associated with the Enlightenment and kind of a post-Christian world, right? And he's going back and say, actually, no, these sources are much older, right? He has the whole liberty before liberalism. And what's striking to me is Skinner is not a Christian. I mean, he's not. He's quite hostile to it, especially in his exchanges later with Charles Taylor and others, where he's. By the way, for those of you who don't know, Quentin Skinner is a intellectual historian from England, Cambridge School historian, as they're called. And I think he's still alive. And he's written many, yeah, actually, he just published a new book, actually. Lots and lots of books on early modern thought. Certainly one of the best scholars of this. But he's drawn a lot of this. Also, Brian Tierney, right, looking at the canon law and how in the far way before Hobbes, a millennia before Hobbes, essentially, you're already getting these notions of natural rights and liberty. And you can also see some of it in the ancients. But one of the things that, because is interesting here now is that so once we have this worked out, that modern social contract theory, devoid of classical natural law, or untethered from it, whether knowingly or not, is self-referentially incoherent. It's a normative failure. It can't ground itself. But then you're going to come back and say, look, it's not. We're not going to abandon it. The American framers didn't abandon it, and so. What are we offering in place of this, right? So you're still saying at the end of this book that like, hey, I'm not getting rid of consent, I'm not getting rid of this natural equality. You're bringing it to, and that's what this is where I want to for the remainder of the podcast get to this notion of covenantal realism, and why, what you're recovering from the ruins of social contract theory and what you're going for here. What is covenantal realism and why is it preferable?
I should note, and I think maybe in contrast to post-liberalism, but that's probably another debate. That my approach is a little bit like Joseph Ratzinger, Benedict XVI, whose approach was there are fundamental problems in modernity, and also we're not going to say to hell with everything in it. It's right.
Right.
He'd say, we want to hold on to our foundations in classical thought, in Christian thought, but we also need to work through. And working through means saying, I think, to some things, not that doesn't fit. Maybe we find something in John Stuart Mill or some later liberals say that's not something. But this over here, this might be compatible with older foundations. Sam Gregg takes this route in his book on faith and reason, which I just commend to folks. Right. So I want to say that there is an older consent theory than modernist consent theory. There are some scholars who try to say, but it only pertained to corporate consent, the consent of the community. It didn't have an individual consent component. And one of those is Frank Oakley. And I have enormous regard for Frank Oakley. I think his trilogy with Yale, beginning with The Empty Bottles of Gentilism, The Watershed of Modernity, is one of the most important things for historians and political theorists to read. Frank Oakley is in his 90s now, just a brilliant mind, and even where one disagrees with him, you learn an immense amount. But Frank is in one of his articles some years ago said, well, really what we find in these earlier forerunners is corporate consent, the consent of the community, not individual consent. And for theorists, the best theorists in this camp, I think, Harold Hopful and Martin Thompson and Frank Oakley, then they want to say that the Mayflower Compact, which was never called that, by the way, it's either called the Covenant or the Combination or the Mayflower Covenant, something along those lines. But the Mayflower Compact is sort of the Rubicon here. But I noticed that scholars who specialize in Suarez will tell you that there are individual consent moments and ideas of individual equality that we find in Richard Hooker, that we find in Suarez, and that we find in others. So I really do want to say that there is a consent tradition that has an individual component grounded on natural equality, found in Bellarmine, Hooker, Suarez, and others that is competing with the Hobbesian tradition. And for that matter, we find the syndic of Emden, Johannes Althusius, in the 17th century in a text that I don't think American founders read. I don't know that Locke read. Rousseau might have known of it, but that's much later. That is sort of the first comprehensive covenantal account of political order, not the first covenantal account, but the first comprehensive covenantal account. And these guys are committed to moral and metaphysical realism, the idea that there's such a thing as human nature. There's such a thing as what is really good for human nature. There's an objective right and wrong. And Althusius will say that covenant, by which we mean agreement, is necessary for creating human communities, both pre-political and political. And I want to argue that the American founding and framing is rests on these older traditions. So I would like to say that there is an older tradition than Hobbes, that we in the Reformed Protestant world that we might call the covenantal tradition. And I think there's some distinction, as Dan Elazar did, from Calvinism, but in the covenantal tradition that views the world as ordered and by a covenant with God or a covenantal order God establishes, and then human relations are created. This covenantal stream is grounded in moral and metaphysical realism. I think in a way that Martin Luther was not. Martin Luther said that he was a terminist. That was a word at the time for nominalist, that he was of the school of Occam, and also describes just and unjust as having no other foundation than divine will, divine might. So, of course, Luther says lots of things, but that's one strain of the Reformation. There's another strain, the covenantal strain, that has its roots in Zurich rather than Geneva, perhaps. But these guys are grounded in what they call the via antiqua, the idea that moral and metaphysical realism, real goodness, not created by will or not sheer divine omnipotence. I want to say that American constitutionalism and the American founding has some roots in that, but also following Skinner. Skinner is just is volume two of Foundations, really both volumes, but volume two of Foundations for what we're doing here is utterly brilliant. My work very much engages his work on this. He was the first time I ran across some of this, not all of it, but the first time I ran across some of this. Was working through Skinner, and I want to say that there's also a route to consent theory in the theorists he discussed discusses from Salamanca, Spain, and things like that. Say so. There is this kind of political theory, government by consent, that has its roots there, and we find it in folks like Suarez, and in terms of the consent of the governed, the right of a people to depose and replace tyrannical leaders. We find that in Bellarmine. We find Sir Filmer attacking Bellarmine and Suarez. Sir Filmer is infamous for his work Patriarchy or Patriarcha, which he rejects natural liberty, the idea that nobody is a subject or ruled by nature. We say, well, who is Filmer critiquing? Who's he going after when he rejects natural liberty and he rejects natural equality and he rejects the authority of the community over government? Who's he attacking? And the answer is the Thomist Robert Bellarmine, and Francisco Suarez, and then Locke attacks Filmer exactly where Filmer goes after Bellarmine and Suarez. But more importantly, for our purpose, or as importantly, Algernon Sidney, who was deeply influential with the American founders and framers, according to Jefferson, one of the sources, one of the four main sources for the Declaration, according to John Adams, one of the maybe six main sources for the American Revolution. Sidney expressly defends Bellarmine against Filmer. And Jefferson had this huge copy of Sidney's discourses, It's just enormous that I flipped through. And if you let your eyes rest on the page at all in those opening chapters, you see clearly Sidney defending the Thomist Bellarmine. But I think it's more than just historic connections. What I like to say is that the American founders and framers insisting on the necessity of consent could also make distinctions. They would say things like, not Hobbes. Hobbes' account of the state of nature has no moral law. And Hobbes holds that virtue and right and wrong are constructed, says Alexander Hamilton, and this undoes everything. James Wilson, in his law lectures, says the ultimate foundation of government by consent is natural law. And the ultimate foundation of natural law is divine goodness and wisdom, together with God's will in prescribing. But divine will is always effectuating divine goodness and wisdom. And what the natural law prescribed by God contains in its commands are commands that are in, they prescribe real intrinsic goods for us and prohibit real intrinsic evils. And Wilson will say, not Hobbes, Wilson will also say, you know, Blackstone's theory of authority sounds like a command-based theory of authority, a will-based Hobbesian theory. So not Blackstone. That's interesting. And then you say, well, who are we going with, Mr. Wilson? And he's probably not in that setting going to say, oh, you know, it's Thomas Aquinas. He doesn't say that. But he says it is Cicero and Richard Hooker. That is, he appeals to two people who explicitly reject a will-based approach to ought and ground it in goodness and reason. And if we read, and I don't, I have another, I have two other books that are in the works. Ben Peterson and I are working on something actually,
Excellent.
on the place of virtue in American founding thought and elsewhere. But in one of the volumes I'm working on, I survey the literature on the nature and foundation of moral obligation in founding thought. There's an actual something of a literature on that. And some of that literature is in the moral philosophy lectures of the universities that the founders and framers would have sat through. And those were often delivered by university presidents. And what we find in those is a kind of dual foundation. They will say, listen, the moral law cannot be grounded in divine will alone. Yes, in divine will, but it must also necessarily be grounded in divine goodness and wisdom. We find that in Thomas Clapp, for instance, or in James Madison's teacher, John Witherspoon. We find an argument against trying to ground morality and ought in will alone. He'll say, yes, we do need God's will, but also we need, but that's not enough. And by itself, that's incoherent. We also need divine goodness and divine wisdom. And so it must be founded in both these things. I think the best way to get at that is what I would call a compound theory of moral obligation, that moral obligation involves reason and will, intrinsic goodness, and prescription. That you need both of those ingredients to add up to moral obligation. And I think that John Witherspoon and Thomas Clapp, the American Samuel Johnson, it's different than the British Samuel Johnson, were all getting at that in their writing. So I think for these guys, let's say something like this. Thomas Hobbes wants to ground morality ultimately in will. And therefore, the covenant that creates the political order. Hobbes also seems to treat the agreement or the covenant by which the state of nature is left as a hypothetical rather than an actual agreement. That is, Hobbes doesn't think the state of nature ever actually existed, or in its pure sense, the condition of mere nature, we might call it the pure state of nature. Say, did that historically exist? And for Hobbes, the answer is no, or probably not, or it doesn't matter, right? He says there are three kinds of instances of it, like civil war, but the pure state of nature, the war of everyone against everyone, did that exist? No. Hobbes' point is that if you didn't have sovereign power in a commonwealth, this is what life would be like. And that would be awful for you, since you live in constant fear of sudden and violent death in a short life, and that's the greatest object of aversion, and so the greatest evil for you. And so, if you were in a state of nature and you could escape it, you would, which means that you would consent to leave it. It's something like this: you implicitly, as it were, consent to the establishment of a political authority because that's what it takes to get out of the state of nature, or more aptly, to avoid falling into it. So for Hobbes, the state of nature is not a historical state of affairs, not doing history. So remember that he says science proper is not a posteriori or based on experience, but it's deductive. And he says politics is a deductive science. So the state of nature isn't about history. This is not, this happened. This is what it would be like if it did. And if it did and you were in it, you would consent to escape it if you could. So Gregory Kafka says, quite rightly, Hobbes is a hypothetical consent theorist. Well, I think John Locke, but also the American founders and framers, and that they didn't follow Locke in everything.
Right.
But they knew better than to think hypothetical consent could work as a kind of normative grounding principle. The reason hypothetical consent doesn't work is there's no obligation to keep agreements I would have made but have not in fact made, right? There's a famous quote, and Robert Nozick comes up with a kind of amendment of it, and his version goes something like this: hypothetical agreements are not worth the paper they're not written on. Right. So, suppose somebody came up to me, a woman comes up to me and says, "Well, there's a state of affairs under which you would have married me, and so you owe me the obligations of a spouse." Right. And I go to my wife and I say, "Well, I'm sorry, but she'd have reason to be angry with me, and that's because I never actually promised this person anything, and it doesn't matter that I would have, under some conceivable state of affairs, made a promise to her. What matters are promises I've actually made." And consent theory gets all of its capital, as it will, if you will, from the idea. Or all its plausibility from the notion that we are applying the moral norm of keeping our promises. Well, the only promises we're bound to keep are promises we've actually made. But if we are basing political theory on that moral norm in some way or other, that there are such things as binding agreements, and that it is a matter of right and justice to keep binding agreements, and that breaking faith is one of those things that is intrinsically wrong, where we're talking about valid agreements. Then promise keeping must be based on a coherent account of morality or natural law, and the purely will-based account of it isn't a coherent one. And so, the only version of "we should keep our promises" applied to the foundation of political order is one that is grounded in, hey, it's really good to keep your promises, and it's really bad to break faith. And that's not just a matter of us making it up, or of the law saying so, or even of irresistible divine might imposing it sheer fiat.
Well,
So,
let's stop there though, because I think there's still a problem here. Because if you once you get to that point, we're left with the issue of, okay, what do we do when people disagree about what that intrinsic good, even if we say yes, there's some kind of intrinsic right and wrong, intrinsic good and evil, and it's not based on will, it's not simply just based on desire, it's not simply just based on because the majority says this or that, but we're running into disagreement. And this is the perennial problem with natural law, right? In the sense that there is, even if we admit that there is a natural law, What do we do with the disagreement? This came up, very early in the history of the Supreme Court, for example, right? Is it James Iredell or someone who essentially says something to the effect of, we can't base this on natural law anymore because we're not going to agree on it. I'm obviously oversimplifying this, but
Right.
that we're now we're at a new problem. Where and I want to, the two problems I want to finish here with is this problem of, well, who's it's kind of this the Alistair McIntyre thing, right? Whose goodness, whose rationality, but also the problem of consent, which we still have it, the de facto and de jure. We'll come back to that in the end, but let's deal with this one first. So what do we do with this? Well, I mean, okay, let's admit natural law, let's admit intrinsic goodness. Are we still in a situation where, it ends up, it comes down to a vote, it comes down to the will of the stronger, the intrinsic goodness of the stronger?
Yeah, so I think the first thing to say is the argument so far, we've been dealing in the realm of say ontology. What is the case? What does it take for a coherent account of natural law? Oh, and in relation to that, by the way, I mentioned James Wilson before. James Wilson, and this pertains to what you just asked, in his law lectures, says, government by consent, all for that, even for what, maybe not even for at least much of what Locke says in the two treatises. But then he looks at Locke's essay concerning human understanding, and he says, you know what, if we start with Locke's essay concerning human understanding, we'll end up with the skepticism of David Hume, and if we reject Hume, we must reject Locke when it comes to theory of knowledge, or when it comes to human understanding, when it comes to epistemology. And so Wilson says, so Locke's essay concerning human understanding is out. We're not going to go with that. I think the problem is, first, when it comes to we have to distinguish between what is the case, what it takes for consent to be coherent, and I'm arguing it's a natural law foundation. And my argument is something like this. Without a real uncreated good, without something a lot like traditional natural law, or maybe just traditional natural law, then consent theory is ultimately incoherent. And what that tells you is you must affirm them together, if you will, or if you reject traditional natural law, you must also reject the necessity of consent for political authority and obligation. That doesn't yet get you to the, hey, you should affirm natural law, by the way, or you should affirm the necessity of consent, because for the necessity of consent, you need to be able to affirm human equality, which I think is good and right, and I think it's natural. And also, I think that an awful lot of people for human history missed it. It really took natural revelation to supply a corrective on human equality. So it's a natural truth. But to apprehend it, really something like special revelation was required. But the next question is epistemology, is the one you're getting at, which is a sort of the how do we know? Or what do we do when maybe we think we know, but other people think they know, and they think they know differently than we do? And so there's an epistemic question and a practical question there. I think one kind of response on the epistemic question is that the sort of J. Budziszewski line in What We Can't Not Know is that we often know more and better than we think we do, right? That is, we can't just listen to people's denials here. We have to listen to, we have to watch how they act, listen to what they say in relation to it, but often that reveals some level of moral understanding. And I think we also have to realize that moral disagreement is not radically widespread. It's very real, but it's not just C.S. Lewis at the end, at the appendix of The Abolition of Man, which he started putting together before he was a Christian, as it happens.
Cool.
Work by the Adels, Anthropology and Ethics, the philosopher James Rochelle, there, and Frank Beckwith has a wonderful little chapter in his anthology, "Do the Right Thing," which I think is also a chapter in Defending Life. But the point is that that I think you get from Lewis, and that you get from the Adels, and that you get from Rochelle, and from Frank's work is something along these lines. Moral disagreement, and you get from Hadley Arkus too. Moral disagreement is not as pronounced as some people want to make it seem, right? There's this famous conversation that's recounted in Xenophon's Memorabilia of Socrates between Socrates and Hippias, where they talk about the common unwritten laws that we discover as we observe different cultures, and they list some things there. And it turns out that if we do anthropology, comparative anthropology, really well, that we discover that there really are some universals. Long ago, Martha Nussbaum wrote a piece called "Non-Relative Virtues," right? And so the first thing I think is listen. Yes, there is moral disagreement, but we don't have grounds for radical skepticism here, and perhaps we have enough grounds for actual conversation and a deliberative, well-constructed constitutional order can allow for conversations about how moral principles apply. The other thing is, if we're skeptical about morality, it's hard to see why we shouldn't be, skeptical about everything else David Hume wants us to be skeptical about,
Right,
right?
which is everything.
Right. So, there's disagreement, but that doesn't lead us to say there's no right way to do one's thumb, one's sums. Wow, I can speak. There's no right way to do one. So we don't say that because people, students, come out with different answers on the math tests all the time, or just because at some point or other there might have been debate when trying to reach the Pythagorean theorem, right? Even if we still had debate, or we have some people who seem to think the earth is flat, and we don't say, well, we've got the round earthers and the spheroid earthers and the earth has no shape, or nobody can know, or we can't proceed. Some people believe the Earth orbits the Sun, and the Earth is a sphere. And there are others, and there have been, who believe that it's flat, and the Sun rises in the dome of the sky, or something like that. And therefore, we can't put up satellites with GPS. Or people debate relativity. Turns out, GPS satellites rely on things like relativity, right? Why would we apply a different standard when it comes to morals? And the other thing is that this sort of skepticism is ultimately self-refuting. It turns in on itself. The very grounds for being skeptical. And I suppose it's no wonder that David Hume, after commending books that contained errant propositions, be burned in the fire. He was a librarian too, right? He's like, only propositions that are tautological, like all men are bachelors, are true by definition, or propositions that are based on empirical observation are true. And I'm simplifying a lot here, but throw all the rest in the fire. I don't know that he actually did that, but he also said you can't be a philosopher all the time. I'm like, well, no wonder, because you can't really believe anything. So we apply a different level of skepticism to moral disagreement, and I think there's on the one hand less disagreement than we recognize, though there's real disagreement to be sure, but also we extend that to a skepticism we don't under we extend to other areas, right? And so we in morals we get abandon hope all ye who enter, but not when it comes to disputes in matter of science. So yeah no so my my take on this is that there is warrant for discussion, but that people want to pronounce disagreements about the natural law or things like that doesn't faze me so much, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think there's also an element of faith here, right? I mean, even on the, we make the distinction, or some people will make the distinction between morals and sciences, where as if there you need faith, or you just need to, settle with something on the moral side. But hey, we got this empirical solid evidence on the science side. Well, actually, in both cases, there's going to be an element of faith at the end of the day. You cannot avoid it. And when you live into that faith, it turns out, well, reality confirms this, or in some cases doesn't, right? There's an element of it's kind of the reverse of the of science, right? In the sense that we do we deduct, are we deductively getting to the truth? Well, the truth is you have faith, you live into it, and it turns out, yeah, it's true. Which is how, yeah, go ahead.
So I would put it this way. I hesitate to use the word faith, although I could, in terms of using trust, I guess I'd put it this way. Not only are some things properly basic, right? You begin there, but there are first principles of reason, theoretical and practical, or th theoretical reason, that think geometry, for instance, or physics. Practical reason, think ethics and reason about living well. There are first principles, as Aquinas points out, in both these areas, right? The first fundamental principle, the law of non-contradiction in theoria, in theoretical reason. And in practical reason, it's good is to be done and ensued, and it's evil, its opposite, is to be avoided. And these are beginning points. But as C.S. Lewis says, in fact, as Hamilton at one point says, in every area of reasoning, in math, in science, in ethics, and in politics, there are first principles. And as first principles, they're not provable. That we begin with them. We start with them. But if you abandon them, you abandon coherence altogether. That is, if you abandon for if you say the first principles have to be proven, or if I can't establish for this is sort of an oxymoronic kind of thing to say. If I can't establish first principles, I won't accept them. But the first principles, you can't do that. But if you say, well, I can't establish them, therefore I give them up, what you're giving up is ought altogether. That is, you're giving up any basis, not only in ethics, but in politics and in law. And in fact, if you abandon those first principles, ought and obligation are conceptually impossible. But I think we can talk about, we might disagree about ought, but we might disagree about obligations. But what does that disagreement mean? That disagreement means that we both think that these are intelligible. And if our con if we have a conversation and we're not just throwing out sounds that don't mean anything. What's the Shakespearean line about something in fury signifying nothing, right? I've lost the whole line right
Yeah,
now,
I don't remember it either.
but the point is, if it's more than sounds when we talk about ought and obligation, then it's conceptually possible. But if we throw out the first principles, ought means nothing. Obligation means nothing. All there is power and power relations and power play. And we can't even really talk about that in a coherent way.
Right. So let's to close here. I want to deal with this final practical problem that you bring up in the last chapter. This the paucity of consent, as you say. I'm going to read this. This is from page 289. You write that the only sort of intelligible consent theory treats consent as a necessary rather than as either a sufficient or a necessary and sufficient condition of political authority and obligation. Moreover, the consent required is actual rather than hypothetical or merely rationally implied. But no nation state possesses the actual consent of a substantial number of individuals within the territory it purports to govern. A. John Simmons argues that the necessity of real consent, together with its paucity, entails the absence of political authority and obligations, a position he calls philosophical anarchism. So, I mean, we're back to the issue of consent then, where we've said, okay, we can't root obligate, we cannot root the ought and the obligation in consent. We've admitted that we cannot escape the good, and we've admitted first principles, and we're going to keep consent around. But how do we make it useful? Like, how do we get to where we need to be, and how feasible is a practical solution to this problem? So I guess you just could comment on that, because I thought that was a really interesting place where other scholars might build on as well.
Yeah, so first of all, I think A. John Simmons is, like Frank Oakley and Quentin Skinner, just a brilliant scholar. What he does is to say something like this: Locke is right about the necessity of consent for political authority and obligation, and that consent has to be real consent, actual consent, not just hypothetical consent. He says that Locke is right and frames Locke primarily in terms of natural liberty. I prefer to say, well, let's start with natural equality, although I think there's some connection here. Then Simmons says, but David Hume, who did not think consent was necessary, Hume thought consent and agreement is great if you can get it. In fact, Hume thought the very first political societies had the consent of their members, but he says later on that they don't. And if you insisted, you have to have consent, or the leader of this community, or the king, or what have you, doesn't rule, that you'd be laughed out of the community, or maybe shut up in jail or something like this. Like, here's a subversive, or here's somebody who's being ridiculous to insist that consent is necessary. Hume's like, maybe it's sufficient, but it's not necessary, and it's not necessary and sufficient. And what Hume says is, listen, hardly anybody gives it, so hardly anybody who rules has it, or hardly any government that rules has it. And Simmons takes those two and puts them together. Consent is necessary for political authority and obligation. Most people have never tendered actual consent. And he considers, clearly most people haven't explicitly given it, but he considers several mechanisms of tacit consent. And Simmons doesn't say tacit consent, implied consent is impossible. Some scholars they might say tacit consent is equivocal. Simmons says no, that there are situations in which people give clear and meaningful tacit consent. The question is, can a lot of people do that with respect to political authority and obligation in a regime of any size? And he says, no, there are no clear signs of tacit consent. Hobbes, not Hobbes, excuse me, Locke sort of conflates benefaction. We say, Mr. Locke, you concede that most people have never given explicit consent. You say consent is necessary, and necessary, explicit consent is necessary to be a full member of society with all the rights and privileges. But just in terms of an obligation to obey the law, most people have never given explicit consent. But you say tacit consent will do the work, right? Implied consent, where explicit is, I say it out loud, I sign on the dotted line, I write it down, and tacit is it's given implicitly. I do something that does something. I say, what are the signs of tacit consent? What am I doing that gives tacit consent? And insofar as we're talking just about an obligation to obey the law and the political authority of those who exercise the government, and Locke says residence and enjoying the benefits of the place, the benefits of the law, like protection, use of the roads, use of inns, things like that. And Simmons says, well, there's two problems. First, benefaction is a very different, more or less plausible, better or worse account than is consent, right? The theory that we must obey the law, or all other things equal, of an obligation to obey, because we've enjoyed benefits that we've received. This is like consent, by the way, an argument as old as the speech of the laws in Socrates, in Plato's Crito. John Simmons says, listen, benefaction is a different theory than consent theory. And when we speak about consent, when we are authorizing political authority and incurring political obligations, seems like it has to be conscious and voluntary. And people don't sort of consciously and voluntarily reside. Maybe some people do, but by and large, people just reside, right? And they're certainly not consciously and voluntarily saying, "I am signifying authorization of the political order. I am signifying I'm taking on obligation to obey the law." And if we look at things like political participation or voting, well, you already have to be a member of society to do those things. So you're not creating it, authorizing it, giving consent to it. You already belong if you can do those things. So he considers signs of tacit consent and says, we don't have those. He says, it's true that we do have in modern constitutional regimes some consenters. And if we look at the United States, right, we have some people who have given explicit consent, members of the military, more broadly, those who take oaths of office for the government of the United States or the government of their state. And then we have those who have been naturalized in very moving ceremonies and have taken the oath of citizenship. You say, how many people have done that? I won't out a friend of mine because he hasn't taken a formal count of this, but on a preliminary account, he thought that percentage could rise as high as 40%. I think folks like Leslie Green and John Simmons think it's probably more like 5 to 10%. But in either case, it's not a majority, and it's certainly not a substantial majority. It's a minority. It's a small minority, or it's a somewhat larger minority, but it's still a minority. So if consent is necessary, and most citizens or subjects have not consented, then it would follow that government does not have authority, and political society does not have authority over most of those it claims to rule, and most of those within a territory don't have an obligation to obey. You might obey for practical reasons. You don't want to go to jail, so you don't speed. Well, hopefully, not going to jail for speeding. Maybe if you go as fast as Josh does.
That's right. True.
You don't want to get a ticket, so you don't speed. You don't want to go to jail, so you don't steal. Maybe for a lot of us, we think there are certain things in the law that just recapitulate the moral law, like murder's wrong. The law also says it, but I don't murder because murder's wrong, you know. And Simmons says, well, yeah, so you might have moral reasons to go along with the law, but it's the moral reason that's doing all the work, right? Or you might have practical reasons, and you don't need to work to overthrow the state. The question is just, do you have political obligations? And do you really have a duty to obey the law? Does the law have authority over you qua human law? And he says, well, if most people haven't consented, and consent is necessary, right? Then most people don't have those obligations. The regime doesn't have authority over most of those who it claims to rule. This is a major premise, minor premise, conclusion. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. It's a brilliant framing of the argument, and I think just so stated, it'd be pretty damning. I get the sense that there are some political theorists who really don't, but I think they don't because they retreat to hypothetical or implied consent, which again, there's no moral norm to keep a promise I would have made but did not actually make, right? No moral norm to keep faith with an agreement I would have made but I haven't actually made. So it's hard to see how hypothetical consent can do any work here. So you say, well, what do you do? Because the United States, the England of Locke's day, you know, has a paucity of express consenters, and for this reason, not Leslie Green, for instance, will talk about their, being some people who have consented. You know, you have what do you have? A mini state within the state? I don't know, I think there are two things. I really, in theory, in principle, you could get the consent of everyone or most everyone. Of course, you'd still have the question of, young children. You'd still have the problem of, well, I consented then, but I don't consent now. You know, how do we handle that? I think that this raises a problem for a purely individual consent theory, especially in a large society. I think the answer to this is, however, we can't abandon consent altogether because of human equality. So I think there are two ways to proceed, and I don't take them to be mutually exclusive. But one is to say, individual consent is not going to work as a practical matter, though it could in principle. So we're going to have to move to corporate consent. And Johannes Althusius would speak of individuals consenting to create pre-political primary associations, natural, like the family, for instance, and not all, children aren't based on consent, but he'd say marriage is based on consent. Then he'd say there are other things, guilds or collegia, pre-political associations. If we had the separatists or the American Puritans here, who are a bit distinct from English Puritans, they might say something along the lines that they would add congregations to that. That's going to be a point of dispute from an Orthodox, Catholic, Anglican vantage, to be sure. But Althusius at least speaks of these pre-political primary associations that individuals consent to enter into, right? Now, these then, families and collegia, consent together to create the first level of political society, like towns, villages, something like that. And then Althusius will say, villages and towns consent together to create the province. And then provinces, villages, and towns consent together to create the Commonwealth. So he begins with individuals who covenant and agree together to enter into primary associations that are pre-political. And these primary associations then agree together to create the first level of political society, to incorporate the first level of it. And those incorporations create another level. And finally, we arrive at the Commonwealth. And so, really, although he begins with individuals at first or heads of household, we move very quickly to corporate consent. It's just primary level corporate consent, pre-political, then political. The other kind of answer here is to say that human equality entails what we might call popular sovereignty, by which we mean it entails the authority of the community and the rule of the community over its government, that it delegates a government. Or we might say both. And I tend to take a sort of grassroots building from the ground up approach. I think consent theory and he, I think human equality suggests that we really need to begin with primary associations created often by agreement, and then those associations consent together to create political society, and then a sort of primary level of political society consent together to create something more comprehensive, where the smaller political societies cannot provide for the public good of its members by itself, or you have spillover effects into other communities, and you say, you know what, we need something bigger to address that. In both of those cases, we are moving from individual consent to corporate consent. But I think popular sovereignty or the sort of Althusian thing, but I think that these can be defended as compatible with consent theory and addressing the difficulty that a purely individualist consent leaves us with. And what I'm suggesting is then also compatible with the insight that human beings are social and political by nature, not radically individual, right? There's still things we do as individuals. It's individuals who enter into a marriage or who join a collegium or create a collegium or some sort of association. But we are not just individuals. And so Althusius or something like popular sovereignty or both of those things honor both human equality and the fact that we are social and political by nature. I might note then here that Althusius, I think he's not the only one. He's one of the earlier ones to do this, provides us with a way of thinking about consent and covenant or agreement as necessary for political authority and obligation. That coheres with Aristotle. Aristotle famously said that for everything there are four causes, and I'll set material cause aside and formal cause aside. But the final cause, the end or the purpose or the goal, right? And the efficient cause is the cause that make something to be. Maybe it actualizes the potential in the block of marble that leads to it being Michelangelo's David. Althusius says he uses Aristotle's framework, and he says the common good, the public good, is the end of political order, the end of political association, the goal, the reason for having it, and consent is a sufficient cause. And what that allows, Aristotle's causal framework, if we treat consent as the efficient cause of political order, but not the final cause is the public good, that allows a reconciliation of consent theory with Aristotle in a way that honors the patristic Christian idea of human equality. So we're using Aristotle's scheme to bring some things together. That is, political order exists for the sake of the good of the whole, the common good. That is the end or purpose, right? But human beings really are equal by nature, and that necessitates consent. Well, where does the consent part fit in? It fits in as the efficient cause. And if that's the case, there is no contradiction of any sort between classical political thought, Christian political thought, and government by consent.
There we go. That's a great way to end it, man. There's so much more in this book, listeners, that you can explore and build on. You just read anything DeHart's written, and it'll be like a just start creating a reading list. But thank you so much, Paul. I really appreciate this.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Social Contract in the Ruins, University of Missouri Press. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. And you've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. If you haven't heard yet, we'll be having our 2026 conference at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, March 12th through the 14th. Paper and panel proposals are due September 1, 2025, and we hope you'll consider joining us for what is always a great time. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Thank you for listening.